Hello, I'm Liz Jones. If you read my diary in the Mail on Sundays You magazine, then you'll know me and my life pretty well. But if you've always wanted to know more, this is the place for you. Welcome to Liz Jones's Diary, the podcast. I'll be taking you behind the scenes of this week's column before digging back into the archives to find some of the most shocking and hilarious stories from the last 20 years. I'll be doing all this with the help of my assistant, friend and confidant, Nick.
Hello. Man, that's like never, ever, ever do we do that.
The difference is, Nicola, I had sex with them.
Well, yeah, that's a big difference.
There's a big chasm.
There's a big difference.
So there was me, Kylie, Helena Christensen, Paula Yates. It's a very small world, isn't it?
I don't know what to say, really. Well, I want to know, is it good?
I went to interview him. I think it was just after Kit came out and I'd seen that video. And there used to be a video show because there was no internet. There used to be a video show on the Saturday morning. And I kept watching that video and I thought, I have to meet that chest. I had to meet that chest.
The chest was your focal point.
I have to meet that chest.
Okay.
He was so sexy. And I can't remember now who I interviewed him for. And I thought it was Company Magazine, but I think that was Adam Ant. I think I interviewed him for the Sunday Times. And then they sent me to Glasgow to do a live review. And I went to meet him at the Dorchester. And he was so handsome. But after we'd had sex, he said to me, thank you for your support. Never heard from him again. And I remember thinking to my sad little self, well, I'm just a journalist and he's like this chest.
A god.
Curly hair.
Yeah, yeah.
He's never going to be interested in me. And indeed, he then went out with Kylie and then he went out with Helena Christensen and then he went out with Paula Yates. And I've been watching the Paula Yates documentary on Channel 4 this week. It was in two parts. And it was very sympathetic towards her. And I remember when I worked on Company Magazine in Soho, she had a column on Cosmo and she was a big star and I was nothing. But I never felt she was my type of person. She was very confident, very flirty with men, whereas I wasn't at all. Boobs everywhere, blonde hair, like a sort of a cartoon. And I was quite scared of her. And we all sort of quite looked up to her. But I didn't really want to be like her. And I didn't like her on the tube. And I didn't like her on the big breakfast where she draped herself over Robbie Williams and take that. And she had an affair with Terence Trout D'Arby. Do you know, we always used to call him Terence Trout D'Arby.
Oh, I love him.
Sign your name across my heart. I want you to be my baby. Oh, she got all these amazing
love men.
And I didn't really like the documentary on Channel 4 because, you know, it was shown as this great tragedy that she took an overdose of heroin and died after Michael died. And I'm still very upset about Michael dying. When someone you've had sex with dies, it makes you feel incredibly old and incredibly bereft because he was so beautiful and so sensitive and so sweet. Talented.
Really talented.
And there was something, there was one sentence she said in the documentary that I didn't like. And she said, I would never date someone who couldn't fill a stadium.
Oh.
I'm happy with someone who can fill a kettle.
I'm happy with someone that'll wash up.
You know, that's quite an arrogant thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that Michael started going out with Paula because he saw her as a mother figure, someone who could look after him. And there's a very good documentary on iTunes called Mystify, and it was a very unknown story. And that while he was with Helena Christensen, they were very deeply in love. She had, oh my God, Helena Christensen's so beautiful. He was on some sort of bicycle or something. They were cycling around and they had an amazing time. And she had a flat in Paris and he had a house in the south of France. And he sort of got in the way of a taxi, and the taxi driver got out and punched him, and Michael fell to the floor and hit his head on the pavement. And for a month afterwards, he was vomiting and Helena Christensen was trying to look after him. He became very violent and his personality changed. And a scan later on found that he had brain damage.
Awful.
He couldn't taste, he couldn't smell, he was very angry, he was very violent. So they split up because she couldn't cope with him. She couldn't cope with his depression. His bandmates said he'd changed.
Yeah.
So then he started going out with Paula, who I think he saw as someone who could look after him.
And cope, maybe.
But suddenly he got embroiled. The house was raided. They found cocaine. She got in a custody battle with Bob Geldof over the children. He wanted the children. He said she wasn't a fit mother. He had a daughter with her. He went to Sydney on tour, and she wanted to break up with him. He couldn't cope with it. He was phoning people saying, I can't cope, I can't cope. And it was interesting. In the press, they said, oh, it was a sex game gone wrong. He was trying to asphyxiate himself and get an orgasm, and it went wrong. He committed suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, that all sounds... I mean, I remember that, and it all sounded very strange to me.
Terrible.
Yeah, awful. Awful.
So I interviewed Paula's daughter, Peaches, which is Bob Geldof's daughter,
yeah,
with Paula, in 2008. And we didn't really get on, did we?
It didn't seem like it, no.
Now, bear in mind that Peaches died from an overdose in 2014 at the age of 25. So I wrote a piece about Peaches in the Daily Mail, and the heading is very prescient, actually. Why I Fear Peaches Will End Up Like Her Mother, Paula Yates.
Which she did. Terrible.
About a year ago, I had an encounter with Peaches Geldof. She was making a documentary for ITV about teenage peers and their problems with eating disorders. She told me that at her school, the loos were always awash with vomit. And she said she wanted to interview me about my own experience with anorexia and my campaign while editor of Marie Claire for more realistic role models in the fashion industry. I turned up at the appointed time to find Peaches reclined on a sofa, mobile phone clamped to her ear, in a vest top that kept falling off her tattooed shoulders, black leggings, badly dyed hair and smudged makeup. She didn't get up when I shook her hand. She just kicked off her ballet pumps and tucked her legs beneath her. If I'm introduced to someone, I stand up.
Mm, I think that's old school, isn't it?
At first, her cockiness and her body language reminded me of her mother, Paula Yates, whom I'd known when I was working on Company magazine in the early 80s, and Paula was working just one floor up on Cosmopolitan. The similarities, though, between Paula and her daughter turned out to be superficial. When Paula was starting out in journalism, she was ambitious, inquisitive, eager to know everything about everybody, brimming with energy and willing to work very, very hard. So she had lots of positive qualities.
Yeah.
Paula dismissed the vogue among young women at that time to want to be taken seriously, keen only to write about Greenham Common and campaigns against domestic violence and date rape. Instead, Paula was sexy, flamboyant, interested more in the new romantic movement than the miners' strike. At the time, it was a very brave stance for a woman to take. We knew her drive and ambition would take her far. And Peaches, when I met her that day, she was so laid back, she was almost asleep. In fact, her distraction reminded me more of her father, Sir Bob Geldof. I've interviewed him as well. I couldn't make head or tail of him.
Couldn't understand him?
No. She mumbled hello. She wasn't even aware that I'd been the editor of a magazine and could barely lift her eyes to look at me, let alone ask the questions the researcher had written for her. The 40-something male crew were almost at the point of mutiny. So tired were they of Peach's constant sniping. "Why don't you make sure you have enough film in your camera before making me start talking?" she whined during one hiatus. Pretty rich from someone who was 18 years old.
She sounds a bit of a madam, I've got to be honest.
When I told Peaches the name of the newspaper I worked for, she almost spat at me, stirring from her stupor. "Your paper helped kill my mother," she said. I replied that I was very sorry that Paula had died of an overdose of heroin in 2000 when Peaches was 11. And I told her I'd known her mum in the early 80s. Peaches rolled her big round eyes. "Let's get this over with," she said. "I'm sick of people reminiscing."
Oh, God. She's got a real personality flaw, hasn't she?
Blame the parents.
Well.
To me, Peaches seems spoilt, bored, and completely undeserving of the enormous leg up she's been given in her chosen career of TV presenter. But I could also see that she was very sad and very angry. She was rude, but I think that stemmed from insecurity. Daughters of beautiful, if flawed, women often find it hard to measure up. She knew she was only on that sofa talking to me because of her famous name. And so it doesn't come as a surprise to me that Peaches, now 19, has been caught on tape handing over £190 to an alleged drug dealer whose previous customers included Amy Winehouse. I can't help feeling sorry for her. I feel sorry for her father too, who, despite saying he would go ballistic if any of his children were caught taking drugs, is as helpless as any parent when faced with a headstrong teenager. But I really don't have any time for a young woman who has been given so much on a plate and is so ungrateful. Of course I understand it's hard to lose a parent, especially when so young. And I can see that Peaches is the sort of girl who needed the guidance and down-to-earth firm hand of a mother. I'm sure Bob is an excellent father, but his daughters are known to wind him round his little fingers. He may feel guilty too that he didn't do more to keep their mum safe. And I know it's fashionable to feel sorry for people who take drugs, that it's an illness, but I think it shows only a complete lack of imagination. If Peaches has turned to drugs, I think it must be because she can't think of anything better to do. She isn't tormented, she's bored. A sometime DJ with the requisite rock star boyfriend, she moves in a social circle that prides itself on being cool and somehow better than the one the rest of us shuffle around in. It really isn't. So after that piece I wrote in the Daily Mail, she was dead a few years later.
Yeah, 2014, I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah. It's heartbreaking because obviously losing her mum at such a young age must have been absolutely awful. She's in an industry which is all about drugs. And patterns repeat.
Yeah, but just because your mum's a TV presenter doesn't mean you have to be a TV presenter. She could have been anything she wanted to be. She could have been a vet. She could have been a nurse. She could have been a teacher. She could have been a writer. She could have worked in Boots. You know, just because your mum's a TV presenter, yeah. You know. And the thing that most annoyed me about the Paula Yates documentary versus the Michael Hutchins documentary is that Michael Hutchins was an artist and he was talented. Paula Yates just had blonde hair and a big bust and asked flirty questions. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I saw an excerpt where she said that she was very much about flirting. She was very much about
communicating. I hate women who flirt.
I don't know. There's nothing wrong with flirting.
It's demeaning and it's ridiculous and it's childish and it's... Yeah, I just can't stand flirty women.
Oh, I love flirting. I flirt with a flipping wallpaper. I love it. But I think it's a difference doing it as part of your personality and doing it to get ahead. But it was quite interesting that she said that she had been flirting and this. And when she went back into it and she was a mum and she had her children and she was with someone in a serious relationship and she couldn't be that flirty person anymore, she wasn't quite sure of how she was going to be, how she was going to communicate. It was almost like taking that ability to flirt because it was now inappropriate.
Well,
it changed how she had to communicate with people.
Women on TV always have a harsh time and they're always judged harsher than men. And I'm going to talk about Gary Lineker a bit later on. The great thing about being divorced,
poor
Nicola,
Gary,
is I no longer have to watch football.
No.
I no longer have to watch football and Football Italia and the highlights.
Rather pluck my chin.
And
we'd be watching
a football match and I just keep saying to my husband, which way are they meant to be going? And I thought the fans all changed ends in the middle.
Oh, no. Thank God. I've never actually been out with a football fan. Out of all the boyfriends and all the men, I've never actually dated someone that's into football. And I am so grateful. I am so grateful for those small blessings.
So all I would say during a football match was, which way are they supposed to be going? Because I just lost track. Which way are they supposed to be going? And doesn't Nesta have shiny hair?
It's above the socks, I like.
So Gary Lineker is back. And I've got a little short story at the end about Gary Lineker.
Oh, Gary.
He's back on telly. But Fiona Bruce is taking it in the neck, isn't she? Now, Fiona Bruce hosts Question Time, which is one of the toughest gigs. You're like a referee at a boxing match, aren't you?
I do
love
Question
Time. It's one of the toughest gigs on telly, and she does her best. And she's got into trouble for sort of defending Stanley Johnson, though it was taken out of context, saying that when he broke his wife's jaw, it was a one-off. So she's now had to step back from her domestic abuse charity, and there's calls for her to be sacked.
Dear. Oh, dear.
But when I interviewed Fiona Bruce in Hampstead in the cafe, lovely woman, she said something much more shocking than that to me.
Is this going to be like
exclusive? It's an exclusive. Ooh. Fiona Bruce said to me, in my house, we put all the coats on the bottom of the stairs, on the banister, and all the laundry at the bottom of the stairs until someone takes them up. And I'm like, you put coats on the bottom of the stairs?
And laundry.
Put them away. Take them upstairs.
Oh, that's even.
Don't
made me
put
cringe.
Coats on the stairs.
I'd love to see your face if someone put a coat on the banister.
Oh, I went pale.
Oh, dear.
I should have called for her to be sacked.
Oh, dear.
Nobody puts coats on the bottom of stairs in my house. Come on then, Nick, what have you been up to this week?
Well, I have had it with eBay.
Why? eBay queen.
I've been the eBay queen for years, but I've just enough is enough.
What's happened? I can't go on. Do they not want your old pants?
Oh, well, do you know what? With eBay, and you know what it's like? You buy something and then you sell it and like you pay a fortune for something.
No.
And then someone else was buying it off of you and they want to pay nothing.
Yeah.
That's how it works, isn't it? So put some stuff on eBay. And it's like, I had a couple of things on there for like £350, I think they were.
What can you possibly own that is worth that?
I had two first edition tarot decks.
Oh, for God's sake.
So I was selling them to try and get money for the vet's bill. And I got an offer for what? For £50. And I'm like, it's on for 350. Yeah, but I'd be only willing to pay £50.
You're the Linda Evangelista of eBay who wouldn't get out of bed for less than £10,000.
Do you know what? I literally thought, bugger off. And my first instinct was to email back and say I would rather put it in the log burner and get the few seconds of heat from it that I could than let you have it
you
for 50
bastard.
Quid. You bastard. And then I thought, I'll tell you what, why don't I send it to you? Don't worry about paying. Don't worry about it. I'll send it to you. with a takeaway and my kidney, shall I? Just take it. Just have it. Just have it. So in the end, managed to, like, negotiate a price that was ridiculous anyway, but I really wanted some money for me, cat's medication. By the time you sell something, the eBay fees and the absolute monstrosity now that you pay for postage, it's not worth selling anything. It's just not worth selling anything. So I am done.
I hate my postman.
Done.
I hate my postman.
Why do you hate your postman?
He makes a dog bark and then he runs away, and what, he's wearing high vis. Does he really think he's going to get run over? Why is he wearing high vis? Why does everyone wear high vis?
I think he has
to, don't
you?
I don't have to. No.
I like my postman. He's ever so nice, bless him.
But Nick, you've sold loads of my stuff on eBay, haven't you?
I have, but it's always the same. It's always like you're trying to buy something on eBay and you make an offer. Now, I wouldn't make a rude offer. I consider that when someone has put something on for a price, when I make an offer, I keep it reasonable. You know, I keep it like, I don't offer 50 quid for something that's 350 quid. If it's 350 quid and I don't want it for more than 50 quid, I just don't make an offer. It's literally, I came away and I just thought, you know what? I'm just deleting it. I'm just bloody deleting it, because by the time I've paid eBay, by the time I've let you have it for nothing, just have it.
I wrote a piece for the Mail about this. Another one. About reselling my clothes.
Yeah.
And we have sold lots of things, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've sold my Prada shoes and my Bottega dress and my chest of drawers from Nicole Fari, which was £4,000. Yeah. What did I get
Gucci
for that?
Boots.
400.
Yes.
I ridiculous. Sold every issue of Vogue that I'd collected since 1977, worth millions, and I sold that for £400. And so there was this big thing in all the papers and the Times. I sold my wardrobe and I earned £1,000.
Good luck.
And I sold this and I earned it. So I wrote a piece for the Daily Mail which was counterintuitive. Keyword there. Because they like you to be counterintuitive, saying, actually, you're always going to make a loss. You ain't going to make money. You're losing money. I've sold all my books on Zifit.
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't even sell the one I wrote. They said, this is not needed at this time.
Oops.
So I sold all my lovely fashion books on Zifit, and they're like 50p, 20p a pound. So I said, actually, in the Daily Mail, you're not making money. What you need to do, rather than selling stuff at a loss, is to not make mistakes in the first place. And I also said, if you keep selling stuff, how are you going to hand down, as I did, my grandmother's engagement ring from the 1920s, platinum and diamonds, to my niece when she got married, because that's the only thing I had to give her. If I'd sold it, we're not going to have any heirlooms. If eBay had existed after the First World War, it didn't, did it?
No.
After the First World War, my great aunt Nell in Turlin lost her fiance. All her hair went straight and grey overnight, and she never got married because there weren't any men. Bit like here, really.
Bit like me, really.
She turned to lace making, and I have got the bedspread she made,
which is beautiful.
After the First World War.
Yeah.
But if I'd sold it on eBay, I wouldn't be able to hand it down to anyone.
I know, but there are things that you don't want. And also, needs must where the devil drives, I'm
there
sorry.
There are things. No, all my things are investment dressing. I don't buy necks, Nicola,
no. But you've got a vet bill and you've got a first edition. You try and deal with it.
Tarot cards don't have first editions, Nicola.
Oh,
they don't.
Oh, believe
they don't.
Me.
It's nonsense.
Oh, believe me. If you, some tarot cards, your Prada whatever's will be nothing in comparison to what some tarot cards are worth. Honestly, if
but
you get
are they useful? Do they tell the truth?
They do. Yes, they do.
The number of times over the last 15 years I've asked you, Nick, consult the tarot, should I do this? You said yes. Mistake.
No, it's like, no, reading for you is a completely different issue because, like, You don't trust it anyway. It's all the wrong vibes. It's all
no. You don't blame the client.
You're not a client. You're like Voldemort, sucking the joy out of the tarot cards.
Do you want to hear this week's column?
Tell us.
In which I seek celestial solace.
There's a great picture. I mean, I have to say, the illustrator's done really well lately. This is another really great illustration, isn't
She's only got 50% of the collies in, though.
Is it the good ones? Is it the well-behaved ones?
Yeah, she's only got two of the good ones. While I wait for my online CBT course to begin, I turn up for my second face-to-face with a therapist. I've turned into Prince Harry, only with more hair and way more rescue dogs. Gracie is now wearing her tabard.
Gracie.
Which is supposed to signify she's an emotional support dog, therefore allowed entry. I only have Mrs. Tabard to hand, which already had the word nervous written on it, and I added underneath in felt tip human. So it now says nervous human. The receptionist said, go in, it's fine. I look terrible. There seems no point in doing anything, even having a bath. An oily soak was once my salve, but now I don't see any point, especially when I've got the smart meter downstairs. The therapist has last week's questionnaire in her hands. It's like going and getting your homework marked. She's worried. This goes back to Michael Huntress, you see. Sensitive artist.
Very sensitive.
She's worried that on a scale of 1 to 10, when asked how likely I am to commit suicide, I'd put 9. I tell her the only thing keeping me alive is that my dogs and horses rely on me. If I'm out of sight for even a few seconds on a walk, Minnie puts her paws on a wall to try and spot me. And when she does spot me, her black and white face is washed with relief and joy. Have you done anything nice since I last saw you? The therapist said. Something you enjoyed. That's a loaded, you bastard, bastard. This is the only nice thing that I've done in the last week, and it wasn't that nice.
Right, you ready? Go on, I'm ready.
I tell her my friend Isabel, she's the one who drops off couscous.
Couscous without couscous.
She picked me up on Sunday and took me for a snowdrop walk.
That's nice.
It wasn't that nice. Most of them have been trodden on.
Well, okay.
It was for all the world as though she's my carer. It cost us £5 each to get in. It was torrential and cold and freezing, but hundreds of people had turned up, which tells you all you need to know about the Yorkshire Dales. I couldn't wait for the walk to end. I was worried I'd miss all the little signs and get lost and drowned. We joined a queue in the church for tea afterwards. Little old ladies were serving. That will be us in a few years' time, as he said.
Well, that's cheerful, isn't it? That's something to look forward to.
Well, she doesn't cook. Neither do I.
Well, no. Point taken.
I felt sad then, as I know I'll never be surrounded by grandchildren, friends, cake. I always wonder at the people on Gardener's World who say they have been through a hard time, but gardening got them through it. They can switch off. I wonder at Monty Don when he talks about the future. It should flower in 3 years' time. And I always think, how does he know he'll still be here? How does he know he won't be evicted or made homeless or be dead? I think the impermanence of renting a house feeds into this. What's the point in planting anything? I tell my therapist, lovely woman, there is no waking moment when I'm not worried. She says some level of anxiety is normal and useful. It stops us getting run over. I know I catastrophise. In the past, I've pushed through it. Now, I've even backed out of going to the press awards in which I'm shortlisted. Everything that's supposed to bring happiness has only brought me angst and worry and anxiety. Take my wedding, when I worried all honeymoon that my cheque to pay Babington House would bounce.
The days of cheques. When you could write a cheque and make a run
But also the days of credit card things where it didn't go, that they had a little machine that took a copy of it. That gave you like a few days' breath,
didn't it? It did. They destroyed many people's lives when they took away that little tiny margin.
"What gives you pleasure?" she asked me. "I used to love walking my dogs, but now I only think of what might happen. So let me tell you about walking my dogs. It's a military exercise. I went until after Love Island, and then I put on their flashing lights, harnesses, fluoro outfits, Grace's tabard. Missy has to wear a muzzle, as there's a corner she doesn't like, and she goes for Gracie."
Yeah, I don't understand really why it's Gracie's fault that that corner exists, but it is, isn't it? It's absolutely Gracie's fault, but I don't know why.
Missy is so reactive. Do you know, I've watched Missy this morning lapping water. She even scares herself lapping water. She's like, "Oh, oh, lap, 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 oh, oh."
She's literally mirroring you, aren't you? Because we say that you're like that character in Catherine Tate, you know, open a bag of crisps, not doorbell, Missy is mirroring you.
It was a dog walk that put the penultimate nail in the coffin of me and David. Faced with what he called a slope, he stormed back to my cottage, taking with him my dog leads. When I got home, I was incandescent. "We could have all been killed. It's a country lane at midnight," he said. He never understood me. Isabel emails. Northern Lights. What's it called? The Aurora Borealis. Nicola?
Yes, yes.
At between 9 and 10 p.m. Me. Which way do I have to be pointing? I once travelled to Angkor Wat in Cambodia to see the sunrise, only to miss it, as I've been telling the very winning Kerry. The long version of my marriage breakup. So we missed it.
Oh, dear God.
And we were pointing the wrong way.
Oh, dear God.
Izzy replies, "Good point. I've no idea. I'll Google it. Honestly, women." And I burst out laughing.
Can't you just stand outside and just look in the sky, you know, and do a 360?
But it's so funny. Two women discussing the Northern Lights. We don't even know which way we should be looking. It's north. It's north. The clue's in the name. I'll Google it, she said. You can read this week's diary in full in Mail on Sunday's You magazine. Gary Lineker.
Poor Gary.
Now, I was on Gary Lineker's side because he's got a rescue husky.
Yeah, poor Gary.
Very nice house in Barnes. Very nice.
And he's got a really endless supply of crisps.
Single.
And an endless supply of crisps.
Oh, I just remember Italian 90. La 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 na 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 na. Nessun Dorma.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good job you explained that.
And I remember when I was renting a flat because I'd fled my home, and I was renting a flat in Finsbury Park watching on a tiny telly. And I remember that Gascoigne got a yellow card, which meant he couldn't be in the next match. And Lineker's face to the referee, like, "You can't do that to him. You can't do that to them." I've been loyal to Gary ever since, Gary.
Oh, and his house in Barnes. I remember Paul Gascoigne. He was a bit of a character, wasn't he?
Do you want more Death and Dorma?
No, I do not. I don't want anything that resembles animals being tortured.
But the reason I'm sort of on Gary's side, and it's counterintuitive, please don't sack me, is I met and had dinner with an amazing woman called Judith Kerr. And she wrote The Tiger Who Came to Tea, and all the Mog books about a cat. Yeah?
Right.
Are you paying attention?
I am.
This is very interesting.
I am. I'm just drinking so I don't cough, because you'll tell
me. She sold millions and millions and millions of books, and I met her for dinner, and she was in her 90s, and she was wearing pearls and a beautiful blouse and a beautiful card. She was just immaculate. And she was born in 1923 in Berlin, to a Jewish family, and she fled the Nazis in 1935, and she came to the UK And she found out that after they fled, the Nazis broke down their front door of their house to arrest them the next morning.
Wow, that's...
And she
scary.
Is an example of someone who came to the UK and she just gave us so much. And during the Second World War in the Blitz, she worked for the Red Cross. Amazing woman. And so I, in 2006, 2007, I did a charity book in aid of Chat, which is run by Celia Hammond, who was a Vogue cover girl, and she runs an animal charity. So I did this book in aid of Chat. And I wrote to so many people asking them to tell me about their cats. Louis de Benier, who wrote Captain Corelli's Mandarin, no. God. Tracy Emin said yes, and she sent me two drawings of her cats, which I then sold at Sotheby's for the charity. Aww. And I remember one of my boyfriends said, you should have kept them. I'm not dishonest. Thank you. Thank you. So I said to Judith, would you write about the cat who inspired Mog for my charity book? And she said yes. And she put it in the post, and I've got it here. Aww. It's a typed short story from Judith Kerr. So she wrote this on a typewriter. So she fled the Nazis and she gave us this. So this is the real Mog. We'd always wanted a cat, and as soon as we owned a house and a garden, we got one. We got Mog. The children loved her, and she was remarkably tolerant. When our two-year-old picked her up and carried her, fondly but upside down, Mog would roll her eyes as much as to say, see what I have to put up with? But she never scratched or bit. She rarely meowed, perhaps because of the constant noise from the children. And so she had to rely on visual effects to make her wishes known. When she thought it was time for her supper, and we were watching television, she would sit on the TV set and hang her tail down over the screen. When she wanted to come in from the garden, she refused on principle to use the cat flap. She would sit on the window box outside the kitchen, and I'd look up from the sink to see this terrible face staring in at me. Terrible face. After a while, we stopped planting flowers in that window box because they always got squashed by her bottom. Her hunting expeditions were often a disappointment. Her great ambition was to catch a squirrel, and she'd pursue one up to the very top of the huge oak tree next to the road, whereupon the squirrel would leap to the next tree and leave her stranded and having to clamber down 60 feet in a very humiliating manner. Mog always hoped to catch one of the sparrows on the roof, but they were too cunning for her. They would tease her by fluttering just out of reach until one day, when she leapt to grab one, she accidentally leapt right off the roof. My husband happened to be looking out of the window, and he suddenly saw a furry shape shooting past.
Oh, Mog!
We all rushed downstairs. We were sure she'd been killed, but she just picked herself up and walked a little stiffly to the boiler, where she sat for a long time, looking very thoughtful. Mog was so much a part of our lives that when I started doing picture books, I thought I would make one about her, putting in all the things she did, as well as all the things the children and my husband made up about her. Mog was immediately very interested. She would come up to the room where I worked at the top of the house and sit on my lap. And as I drew and painted the pictures, she would watch the paintbrush. And sometimes she would nudge it gently with her nose. As more Mog books followed, it became a regular practice. But the odd thing is that she only did it when I was working on a book about her. I also wrote and illustrated other books, but when I was working on those, she kept away. Mog lived to be 18, and in the last years, her hind legs tended to give way, and she hardly moved from her place by the boiler in the kitchen. By then, there had been quite a few Mog books, and the children used to say what a pity it was that she didn't know she was famous. However, when the BBC suggested making a short film about her, we at first said no because we thought it might upset her. But they promised to be very careful and very quiet. And so in the end, we agreed to let them try. We needn't have worried. As soon as the camera crew arrived, Mog seemed to understand this was her chance to be a star. She took direction. She did the business with the cat flap. She made her terrible face on the window box. She did everything they asked her. We couldn't believe it. But as she seemed happy, we wondered whether she might sit on my lap while I worked. Something she hadn't done for years because, with her hind legs, she could no longer climb up the stairs. So I carried Mog. Oh, I'm crying now.
Oh, I know.
Up the two flights, and she became very excited at seeing the top floor again.
Meow! Meow! It's just like you're singing.
And when I got out my paints and brushes, she sat on my lap and watched what I was doing. And after a while, she nudged the paintbrush with her nose. They got it all on film, and she finished off her performance with a full minute's purr into the microphone for the sound man. I carried her back downstairs and put her in a basket. Later that evening, long after the camera crew had gone home, I went up to the top of the stairs to reach something. I went up to the top of the house to fetch something, and there was Mog. Goodness knows how she managed the stairs, but she must have wanted to take one more look at her past. She walked very slowly across the landing into my workroom and then into my husband's workroom, and she looked very carefully at all the things, at the desks and the typewriters and the paper and the paint and the chair she used to lie in and the window she used to climb out of. And when she had seen everything, she lay down on the floor and I carried her back down the stairs to her basket and she went to sleep. That was the last thing she did. She died soon afterwards, but she died knowing that she was famous.
Oh, my God.
Poor Mog.
Oh, I feel very teary.
So what an amazing woman, Judith. And if
she amazing cat.
If she'd stayed one more day in Germany, her family would have been arrested.
Isn't that unbelievable? That just shows, doesn't it, like how you can do something and it change your life forever. That's incredible. And that cats are very special.
Every week, lots of you get in touch telling me what you think about my life and my decisions. So I think it's only fair that you get to have your say here on the podcast too. If you'd like to get in touch, then go to lizjonesgoddess.com or tweet me at lizjonesgoddess.
Do you want to know what the letters are this week?
Only if they're positive.
Well, Nina got some information for you. She says, I must inform Liz that Tony Hancock was only 37 years old when he made the blood donor. He was only 44.
Which Nicola has never seen or heard of.
No.
I have to point that out. She's never seen or heard of the blood donor.
My mum knows it and she confirmed. She said it wasn't funny.
It was funny.
She said it wasn't funny.
They won a whole armful.
It wasn't funny. So she said he was only 44 when he committed suicide. And she's mentioned it because she referred to him as an old man in a trilby.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because
they all looked old.
He looked, because he dressed old. He wore a hat. And I remember even when my mum wasn't very old, she looked old to me.
But I think it was the age, wasn't it? I mean, let's face it, Bing Crosby never, ever looked a day under 40, did he? Or Fred Astaire. When did Fred Astaire look young? Did Fred Astaire look like Fred Astaire in the crib? Did he?
Was there I think Fred Astaire just looked exactly the same his whole life.
His whole life. He always looked about 45.
But Fred Astaire got to meet Paul Newman and Steve McQueen.
He did, but he looked like their father, even if he was only 20. Anna says, I've never emailed a person in the public eye before.
I'm not in the public eye, Anna. I'm completely closeted.
Oh, you're not that closeted. We know all about your 3.5 men. So she's having read your column today.
I think Michael Hutchins was the half, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, he was the three.
I was a lot younger then.
So, yeah, but you could die happy, couldn't you? Let's face it. Even if you'd have died the day after, you'd have died happy.
Not when he says thank you for your support.
Well, I'm not being funny. You take what you can get, Jones. Most people would be grateful. Right, so she says, get back to poor Anna. I take citrella plan and I have done for 20 odd years. I've definitely changed my life and it's helped me through difficult times, including widowhood. I hope very much in time you'll feel more positive and certainly the major benefit that I have felt since taking the medication. I read your column each week and I understand how difficult it is to be single-handed, but it can be done, especially with little help. I'm not wealthy, but I've got lots of friends who are, and feelings of envy are difficult on occasions, but their friendship is far more valuable than anything I could buy. Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Oh, what a lovely woman.
That is lovely. And
maybe she could be my friend.
You've had so many. I mean, it was really difficult.
How many?
So many. Loads. I'm still answering them. You know, we've had so many emails wishing you well, sorry that you're feeling so down, worried about you, sharing experiences about how they've got through their depression and how they've coped. We've got therapists offering you treatment.
I don't think I'm depressed though, Nick. I just think I'm anxious. I think there's a difference.
No, there is definitely a difference.
But why isn't there medication designed for anxiety and a medication designed for depression? Why do they lump them together?
I think there is something different for anxiety. I mean, I'm obviously not an expert, but I think there is. But I'm sure one of our experts will tell us. But honestly, you've had so many emails. And
is everyone in the UK feeling quite depressed and anxious at the moment then?
I think a lot of people are. And also, you know, everything's relative, isn't it? I mean, obviously, your life is relative to you. Mine's relative. But some of the things that people have written in with, people have had the most awful, difficult, horrendous lives. And it's amazing to me, reading some of the people's experiences, it's amazing that, you know, that they've still functioned and they've got on with it. But with such a positive attitude, some of the things that people go through is absolutely unbelievable and incredible. And I can't tell you how much I respect some of your listeners and your readers for the amazing things that they've got through, and they've still got this amazing positive attitude, and they're taking the time to wish you well, which I think is really lovely.
Well, it's like the mother, Anne, who contacted me saying, oh, Liz, I hope you're okay. And her daughter's paralysed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she can't even move her head. And yeah, she's concerned about me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think there's such a, in all the negativity in the world, in all the bad things that are going on, in all the horrible stuff you read and the bullying and the social media stuff and that, there is so many good people out there, and it just shows that when you go public and you say, I'm really struggling with this, so many people come forward and go, yeah, me too, or I have in the past and this is how I got through it. And I think that's what's really special about women. It's how we all band together.
Is it mainly women messaging me then?
You have had a couple of guys, to be fair, you have had a couple of guys wishing you well, but the deep sort of stories have mainly come for women. You've had therapists offering to help you. And I think that is what's really special about us women. We will get together and we will share and we will try and help. And I think that's amazing.
Well, a big thank you to them. And I think, obviously, we're going to reply to everything. I think maybe one day we should do a podcast where we all share our stories and we talk about how we get through stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that's it from us this week. If you enjoyed listening to Liz Jones's Diary, the podcast, why not visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. I'll be back next Sunday, but for now, I'm Liz Jones.
And I'm Nick.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.